Main Street, presented and edited by Debbie Ridgard. Researched and produced by Mary Claire Ridgard. This programme was made with funding from the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with the television licence fee.
It's a busy morning on Main Street in Tremore. Cars making their way down the one-way street, locals gathering for their weekly chit-chat by the V Bistro, and people from across the county queuing up to buy a fresh loaf of the famous bread from the Seagull Bakery. In the space between my childhood here and now in 2023, the Main Street has passed through several stages of development. Forever remembered as the now extinct Extravision by anyone born before the turn of the century, many have memories of running as fast as you could to the sound of the church bells only metres away, returning that film you really thought you had brought back, and only to be enticed in all over again by the scent of popcorn bursting through the doors. Or maybe you get a sense of déjà vu further down the street, being fitted for your first school uniform at Kelly's Classics and treated with a trip to the art shop for some bonbons afterwards, a place now reimagined by another local business, the Arch Barber. The Main Street holds many more of those moments from people who have passed through the street at any point in their lives. It's a funny thing, memories, whether you grew up in the area, visited friends on occasion, or simply walked through once. Each location holds echoes of lives lived, fleeting moments, and of course, stories yet to happen. So what tales are connected to Main Street, and how has this Waterford town developed over the years? Tremore, the anglicised pronunciation of Trovor, meaning big beach or strand Osqueilge, boasts the beach that stretches some 5 kilometres, with the town itself only around 5 kilometres squared. Located in the southeast of Ireland, Tremore lies within Waterford, home to the country's oldest city. Steeped in history, Waterford has been home to quite a busy port over the centuries, trading with England, Spain and Portugal in the 16th and 17th centuries, and later Newfoundland in the 18th century. Tremore has long been known as a tourist location, with many people descending upon the town for the sand, sea and sunshine. Some enjoyed it so much, they made it their home.
My name is Mary Claire Ridgard. I'm a historian and a genealogist.
Mary Claire is originally from Dublin and settled in Tremore after marrying a local, starting a job on the Main Street and having 4 children, including me. She holds a Master's in History of Family from the University of Limerick, and over the past few years, she's been researching the development of the Main Street of Tremore from the 19th century onwards, looking at its population, businesses and structure of the Waterford town.
Tremore began as a small fishing village, which developed over a few centuries, but it became more popular partly due to an article being written by a British doctor, Dr. Russell, who proclaimed that seawater was good for your health. Tremore was so near to Waterford that it was quite accessible.
Houses were scattered erratically down the hill from the thatched church to the strand, which eventually became the Main Street. Described as the village of Tremore in 1774 by Charles Smith, he remarked that Tremore was simply a pleasant retreat for the citizens of Waterford and others, assembling here simply for the benefit of the salt water during the summer months. Thanks to investment by a local merchant, Tremore then earned the title of a town in a guidebook in 1786, yet the population in 1814 was just 724 inhabitants. An author, Henry D. Inglis, travelled across Ireland in 1834 for his novel documenting a journey across the island during spring, summer and autumn. Noted for Waterford, he wrote,
"There are 2 watering places, or rather sea bathing places, in the vicinity of Waterford, Tremore and Dunmore. I visited both. The road lies through an uninteresting country and the places themselves are merely an assembly of indifferent houses. The beach at Tremore, however, is remarkably fine, and no shopkeeper at Waterford is entitled to hold up his head, which does not spend a few weeks with his family at Tremore."
A lot of merchants decided to build holiday homes out in Tremore because of the lovely seaside, and in particular one merchant was called Bartholomew Rivers, and he was one of the first developers in Tremore and built a couple of houses on Strand Street Terrace opposite AIB now, and he also built a thatched church where the Catholic Church stands now, and he built assembly rooms that's still now there at the bottom of Patter Street, and I think it's the Bridge Club. And he built the Grand Hotel, which he called the Great Hotel.
Bartholomew Rivers is credited for the early stages of transforming the small fishing village to a tourist town. Not much more than a place for sea swimming in Waterford, when Bartholomew Rivers built the Great Hotel, now known as the Grand Hotel, marked a huge milestone for Tremore being destined to become a tourist destination. The surname, Rivers, is memorialised by an area of the town named Riverstown. However, it may not be him who it gives a nod to.
Originally, people thought it was from Bartholomew Rivers, who is considered the founder of Tremore because he was the first commercial developer, really. But it was probably his nephew's son, Joseph, who actually lived down in Riverstown in Crowbillay House and owned a lot of land around there.
It was around 1793 that Bartholomew Rivers began to run into some financial difficulty. He declared bankruptcy. However, some of the property in Tremore remained in the family. His grandnephew, Joseph Michael Rivers, continued to own property, including on the Main Street, in the 1850s in Tremore. At the same time as the early developments by Bartholomew Rivers in the area, Tremore was also becoming well known for horse racing.
Bartholomew Rivers is also renowned for creating the first race course on the beach in Tremore around 1785. Horse racing was generally for the upper class. They had plenty of horses and it was a pastime. A lot of them took part in. So by 1807, it became a six-day event once a year in August, which is basically the forerunner of what happens here now. They also had a steeplechasing event, which was run over 2 miles. It started at the back of the church, out to Coolnapoge and back in again.
Upper-class members of society had started to recognise Tremore as a place to visit. However, Tremore Bay itself had become known for something else. Located on the south coast of Ireland, Tremore had been defined by sea tragedy over the years. Shipwrecks were common, often caused by poor visibility and prevailing winds. Ships would often get dragged into the bay and found it difficult to get out unless the tide ebbed. Unfortunate for sea captains, it also looked quite similar to Waterford Harbour from a distance, confusing some captains who believed they had reached their intended destination. The most notable wreckage happened in 1816, the HMS Seahorse.
The Transport Seahorse No. 2, Thomas Scott Master, sailed from a port in England a few days ago for Ireland, for Waterford or Cork, with a large detachment on the 59th Regiment on board, consisting of about 16 officers, 287 men, 33 women and 34 children. The vessel was driven into Tremore Bay by a desperate gale from the south. The severity of the weather had compelled her to cut her mizzenmast before she came within the bay.
On the 30th and 31st of January 1816, a convoy of ships, the Seahorse, Lord Melville and Boadicea, was shipwrecked in an unexpected storm. En route from Kent in England to Kinsale in County Cork, the vessels were transporting soldiers from the 59th Regiment home, along with their wives and children. Almost 600 people lost their lives between the three ships, and 363 alone perishing in Tremore Bay after the Seahorse broke into pieces. This is part of an article published in the Freeman's Journal on the 3rd of February 1816, detailing the tragedy.
It was low water at the time, we believe, about an hour of 1 p.m, which on such a beach rendered every chance of escape almost utterly hopeless. Most of those on board then retired below and resigned themselves to their impending and awful fate. The vessel struck upon the sands about midday between Tremore and the furthest end of the Rabbit Burrow, and in the course of a very few minutes went entirely to pieces. The number of those on board, as stated by one account, which we agreed as accurate, amounted to 394. Of these, 363 were drowned and 31 only saved.
Together, the wrecks represent one of the greatest maritime disasters recorded in Irish waters. It was also the catalyst which brought about one of Tremore's biggest landmarks, the Metal Man. In a bid to prevent further death, 5 pillars to deter sailors from the dangerous coastline were constructed, 2 placed on Brownstown Head and 3 on the Greater Newtown Head in Westtown, with the Metal Man standing tall in the middle. An announcement in the Freeman's Journal on the 29th of June 1821 read:
The Corporation for Preserving and Improving the Port of Dublin and Co. gave notice that they are erecting beacon towers on Brownstown and Great Newtown Heads in the County of Waterford to mark the situation of Tremor Bay by order of John Cossart.
The metal man has now become a synonymous image with Tremor. Of course, along with such a towering figure overlooking the bay, myths of the metal man have entered local folklore. Rumour has it, on stormy nights, the metal man can be heard chanting, "Keep out, good ship, keep out away from me, for I am the rock of misery." And maybe a more optimistic legend is that if a woman hopped barefoot around it three times, she would be married within the year. Although the beacon towers now existed in Tremor, shipwrecks continued to occur on the coastline over centuries, with coal, oil and food washing up on shore following each wreckage. By the 1830s, rumblings of the town seen today were starting to take shape. Tremor saw the upper class descend upon the area, and just 3 years on from author Henry de Inglis's visit, in which he remarked the town was simply an assemblage of indifferent housing, a topographical dictionary of Ireland was published by Samuel Lewis, telling a new story of the Irish town. He wrote:
Many comfortable lodging houses have been built for the accommodation of visitors, and a spacious hotel has been erected by Mr. Rivers on an elevated site above the village. A new line of road on a better level has been constructed from Waterford, and great facilities of intercourse with the city are afforded by numerous vehicles.
This dictionary by Samuel Lewis pointed out the huge strides Tremor had made in many aspects. It had been noted in 1814 that Tremor had only a population of 724, but by 1837 that number had already risen to 2,224. We can see that the area was starting to flourish, but he also noticed the construction of an almshouse by Mrs. Catherine Walsh, made to house 12 men and 12 women. May I also say now that Mrs. Catherine Walsh was the original benefactor of the St. Vincent de Paul. The St. Vincent de Paul in Tremor is still called the Catherine Walsh Trust.
Of course, poverty still persisted in Tremor at this time. The bi-monthly petty sessions detailed the harsh reality of those hard done by.
A Catherine Flynn was convicted of begging at Tremor on the 4th of July 1872. She was sentenced to 1 month hard labour in the city jail. The complainant was Francis Rogers. The witness was a Garrett Raher for the complainant.
Ireland in the 1800s had faced a number of famines and had somewhat become a way of life.
Famines were occurring on a regular basis, and of course then the Great Famine occurred from 1846 up to 1851.
Famines would occur in different locations of varying magnitudes across Ireland, causing hunger and disease. This decimated the lower classes, who survived on the potato crop and grew other crops to export and pay their rent. It's estimated that between 1845 and 1850, around 1.5 million people died in Ireland, and the same number emigrated. In 1841, the population of Ireland was almost 8.2 million people, but by 1871, 30 years later, that number had reduced to 5.4 million. Waterford was one of the first counties to record the failure of the potato crop, with over 40% of the crop lost by spring of 1846. An article in the Waterford Chronicle on the 25th of October 1845 read:
Much excitement and alarm have lately prevailed in consequence of the discovery that the potatoes in many districts have been attacked by a disease which renders them unfit for use as food. So extensive is the mischief resulting from the disease that in many places whole crops have been found to be hardly worth digging.
Farmers and the merchants and the shipbuilders were making huge money and exporting all the crops and grains abroad. Waterford was a thriving community for the higher classes, but the lower classes, most of them were starving. They were tenant farmers and they didn't pay their rent, they were thrown off their land. In fact, it was recorded in 1846 by the local parish priest that four people had died of starvation in Tremor itself.
The constabulary reports of 1846 stated that in the old parish of Islandskeen, just outside Tremor, the potato planting had reduced in the past 2 years from 1/8 to 1/24 as a result of crop failure. The almshouse in Tremor could only house 24 people, 12 men and 12 women, and the nearest workhouse was the long journey away in Waterford.
Anybody who was sick and dying had to go to the workhouse in Waterford. Most of the poorest wouldn't make it because, first of all, they couldn't afford to hire a horse and cart. Nobody would take them in. And the journey itself was quite treacherous. The roads were bad and would take a good part of the day to get in there.
A new workhouse designed by George Wilkinson had been built on a 6-acre site on the east side of John's Hill. It was made to house 900 inmates and the first arrived on the 20th of April 1841. By the end of 1846, the workhouse had become overcrowded and disease-ridden. 200 extra spaces were created, but the demand continued to rise.
The gentry were not put off by the famine. They still continued their race meetings on the beach. Now, maybe not during the actual few years of the famine, but certainly right up to and afterwards again. And there's records of race meetings in the 1840s, the early 1840s, and then again after the famine.
Although cases of the famine and poverty were recorded in Tramore, the village itself was growing. Griffith's Valuation, or the Primary Valuation, was a set of books created between 1847 and 1852. These books gave the name of the landlord, tenant, brief description of the property with acreage and the rateable valuation.
The Griffith's Valuation gave details of all properties and their value and was used to pay rates up to the 1970s.
Through these valuations, we can see upper-class housing was starting to appear in the town. The western region of Tramore Bay, near Newtown, seemed to attract the wealthier population. Griffith's Valuation listed 47 buildings with values above £6 per year in the west side of Tramore, although some of these may have simply been holiday homes for the wealthy. Main Street in Tramore had approximately 73 properties in the 1850s. Almost half were listed as private houses. The other half were businesses or mixed with both residential and businesses, like lodging houses. There was also a Methodist church built in the 1830s at the top of the street where Tramore Butchers and the Turkish Barbers are situated now, and a police station where Brennan's Pharmacy exists today.
There was a police station on the main street at plot number 33, roughly where Brennan's Pharmacy is now. It moved to Queen Street before 1864, as the valuation records show that two new houses were built there instead.
Some confusion lies around where the start and the end of Main Street is, as low numbers allocated to buildings sometimes exist right beside very high numbers on the street. The reason can be traced back to Griffith's Valuation and the beauty of human error. These valuations were completed by fieldwork over a number of years by different people, with some deciding to start at the top of the street and others at the bottom. The properties were recorded by plot numbers on the list in their notebooks, meaning some numbers are actual house numbers, while others are their plot numbers. One of the families living on Main Street in the 1850s was the Halley family.
The first record of the Halleys on Main Street in Tramore was Michael Halley, who was recorded on Griffith's Valuation as operating a butcher's. He was born in 1814. And the only record before that is his parents were married around 1798 in Tramore.
Michael Halley ran a butcher shop in 1850, where Cal's shop is today.
The butcher shop took up part of plot number 69 and also plot number 1 of Market Street, which is right next door to it on the corner. And there was actually a small slaughterhouse in the back. The slaughterhouse is marked on the valuation records for the rates.
Michael Halley had 7 children, 3 of whom died in infancy. Mr. Halley also was the landlord for other properties on the street. He even released a newspaper advert for letting a property in April of 1866, which read,
"To be let, the good business house lately occupied by Miss Kern's apothecary, situated in Main Street, Tramore. A good position for any business. Apply to Mr. Halley on Main Street."
Of course, petty sessions were occurring bi-monthly on Tuesdays in Tramore. And in 1853, Michael Halley and several other grocers on Main Street were convicted at the petty sessions court for using lightweights on the scales at their premises. One of the other grocers was local merchant and postmaster Caesar Fleury.
Caesar Fleury was a native of Dunmore East. And he married a local girl from Tramore, Mary Ann Budd, in 1850, and they operated a grocery
a licensed premises and a post office on the main street. Their business operated from plot number 70, which is now the Welcome Takeaway. And in 1870, this was the highest rateable property at the value of £21 per year. At the age of 50, Caesar was committed to the Fanning Institute, but his wife carried on the grocery business until her death in 1903. Her grocery shop was called Inquire Within for Everything.
At the same time, the Marr family lived at 52 Main Street, one of the cluster of cottages behind where the Arch Barbers is today.
James Marr was a labourer in his 50s, and his house was valued at only 15 shillings. Employment was mainly seasonal for the rural labourer, and so many of them were unemployed for long periods.
A group of entrepreneurs and merchants in Waterford set about encouraging the continued expansion of the town of Tramore, and in the 1850s decided to band together and create a link from Tramore to the city, the railway.
They had to apply to government to get permission to do it, because in those days you had to get an Act of Parliament before you could do that. They got permission and the train line was built within 7 months, which was considered really quick. The first train was in September 1853 and it took on guests, and 200 guests travelled, and they enjoyed it so much that they went back again. It became so popular, within 2 days 5,000 people travelled on the train.
The line was built by contractor William Dargan. The engineer had already built Ireland's first railway in 1831, travelling from Dublin to Kingstown, the country's second railway from Belfast to Lisburn, and then extending it to Portadown and Armagh. Unique in a way, the Waterford and Tramore Railway was 7.25 miles long and unconnected to any other line. Published in the Leinster Express on the 10th of September 1853, the opening of the railway was announced.
The Waterford and Tramore Railway was opened on Monday the 5th instant for traffic. There are 10 trains each weekday and 9 on Sundays. There are only 2 classes of passengers.
Tramore's population was approximately 1,000 in 1853, and in an attempt to build up the town, an offer was put on the table for potential residents.
The Waterford and Tramore Railway, they gave a free first class ticket for 5 years to anyone who purchased a house in Tramore. And they also allowed you to carry building materials free out to Tramore. The Grand Hotel got in on the act and they began to offer combined rail and hotel stays, which boosted the tourism as well. So by 1861, Tramore's population had increased to 1,847.
Tramore had now become accessible from Waterford, a journey taking just 15 minutes to the seaside. At the same time the railway came to Tramore, some wealthy landowners took it upon themselves to further develop the races that were happening in the town. Meetings had become very successful and quite a regular fixture in the higher classes' pastimes. In the 1850s, the Malcolmsons, factory owners at nearby Portlaw, began reclamation work on the back strand. It allowed James Delahunty and Hayes St. Ledger, otherwise known as Lord Doneraile, to move the races from the beach to the back strand.
Just shortly after the railway came, 1854, a local gentry, James Delahunty was his name, he later became MP for Waterford. Him and Lord Doneraile, one of the main landowner owners of Tramore, laid out a racecourse on the back strand down near the sand dunes and started regular meetings there in 1854.
Facilities were basic and a stand house was built for spectators by 1856. Of course, being located near a beach, race meetings were still very much dependent on the weather. This course was the first attempt to monetize the race meetings in Tramore, as it wasn't exactly possible to charge for previous meetings on a public beach. The move didn't exactly prevent locals from sitting on the sand dunes, though, who continued to watch the festivities from afar. Racing isn't the only reason Lord Doneraile is a significant name in Tramore's history. The title Lord Doneraile was held by the St. Ledger family, who owned extensive estates in Munster from about the year 1630. The first Lord Doneraile, Arthur St. Ledger, also called Viscount Doneraile, was given lands in Munster by Henry VIII as a reward for helping him with many issues, one being helping him find a legal way to divorce Anne Boleyn. Arthur St. Ledger's daughter was Elizabeth St. Ledger, and she was famous in her own right as the only lady Freemason who was made a Mason after snooping outside a meeting.
Viscount Donnerail was one of the primary landlords of Tramore. He was director of the Waterford and Tramore Railway, and he lived in the Donnerail estate in County Cork. He owned huge land, around 6,500 acres in Waterford and around 8.5 in County Cork.
The lands in Waterford came into the family through the first Viscount's marriage to Elizabeth Otterington, possibly as a dowry. In 1767, his family line died out and the title of Lord Donnerail was passed on to his nephew. A century later, the fourth Viscount of the second creation was one of the first directors of the Waterford and Tramore Railway Company. Lord Donnerail was also one of the upper class in society to have a holiday home in Tramore. The area, known by locals simply as the Donnerail, is connected to the fourth Viscount. The walk was built for his family as a private walkway near their summer residence. And speaking of landmarks in the town, a religious man, Lord Donnerail assisted in the construction of both the Protestant and Catholic churches in Tramore.
Lord Donnerail donated £50 towards the construction of the Protestant church. He also donated land for the Catholic church, which was built 10 years later in 1860. The tower and spire of the church was only added in 1871 because the Catholic priest wanted it to be taller than the Protestant church.
The population of Tramore had fluctuated like many towns and cities across Ireland in the 1800s. The town looked set to grow into an urban hub with the population tripling in size over 20 years from 724 to 2,224 between the years 1814 and 1837. However, multiple famines and emigration appeared to take its toll on the Tramore inhabitants and the population reduced to some 500 people at one stage. It took a further 40 years to recover. In 1868, an article titled Additional Police for Tramore appeared in the Waterford Mail. It commented on the resurgence of people in the town and called for more help on the ground. Dated the 30th of December, it read,
"The present strength of Tramore Station was 10 men, the same it has been for the past 40 years when it was first established. Since that period, when the population was 500 persons, it has increased and the standing population was at present between 1,800 and 2,000, and in the summer months it was 5,000.
New houses were being built in response to the growing population, and on Main Street there was an increase of 8 dwellings. The police station had moved from Main Street to nearby Queen Street, and to replace it, an additional 2 houses were built.
There was a man called Thomas Lacey, who was an author of Sights and Scenes in Our Fatherland. He visited Tramore in 1862, 10 years after his first time, and he was very impressed by the improved facilities, particularly the early train service. Thomas Lacey also gave most praise for the Catholic Church, which he said was ranked one of the most beautiful buildings in this part of Ireland.
By 1886, Tramore had 7 large hotels, 3 schools and 4 different religious houses. Only 16 properties remained in the same surname as it did in 1850. However, this could be because more married daughters may have taken over the property. The butcher shop on Main Street remained, but now run by Michael Halley's descendant, James Halley.
Another James Halley was born in 1882 and he carried on the tradition of the butchers on the Main Street. At that time, the Halley family house was valued at £17.10, which was quite an expensive property.
Businesses and upper-class society seemed to have flourished at this time. The same, unfortunately, can't be said for those impoverished. Emigration was high during this period, possibly due to poor harvests, evictions and land wars. In 1883, a Labourers' Act provided labourers low-rent houses, which helped cease land unrest and also slowed the rate of emigration. During that time in the 1880s, women had consisted of over half of all emigrants, as there were more opportunities and independence for them outside of Ireland. Back with the upper class, and Lord Donnerail's only daughter, the Honourable Ursula Clare St. Leger, married Baron Castletown of Laois in 1874.
The tenants of County Waterford, including Tramore, raised money to buy her a present, and they sent a present of a diamond and emerald locket with earrings as a wedding present for her.
The wedding couple, now called Mr. and Mrs. Fitzpatrick and Lord Donnerail, visited Tramore afterwards to thank the tenants for their gift. About 2,000 people lined the streets to greet them, and 40 locals joined them at a lunch in the Great Hotel. An article in the Waterford Standard on the 21st of October 1874 read,
"Tramore was one scene of festivity and rejoicing today. The occasion was the arrival of the Honourable Mr. and Mrs. Fitzpatrick, it being their first since their marriage. On Friday, the work of decoration began, and with daylight this morning, the pretty little town presented a very gala-like appearance. On the Tramore Road, groups of persons assembled here and there and cheered vociferously, and the procession moved on. When Tramore was reached, not less than 1,000 persons assembled on the Waterford Road, and amidst a scene of great enthusiasm, the horses were taken from the carriage, the crowd dragging it up the main street."
Chairman Mr. P.W. Power made a speech directed at Lord Doneraile during the lunch, commenting on the Viscount's relationship with his tenants.
"Your Lordship must see that within the past few years, the little town has greatly increased in size and population, and I am glad to say that prosperity has accompanied both."
Following Mr. Power, the 4th Viscount Doneraile took centre stage at the Great Hotel.
"My dear tenantry, I feel very highly flattered at the way your chairman has spoken of my family and myself, and the enthusiastic manner in which my health has been received by you. I must also thank you very much for the compliment you've paid by giving so warm a reception to my daughter and son-in-law on their first visit amongst you since their marriage. Mr. Power has alluded to the friendly relationship that should exist between landlord and tenant. I agree with him in all that he has said, and I may not be perhaps considered guilty of egotism if I say I have ever done everything that was reasonable for the purposes of advancing the interests of my tenants."
That evening, the crowds outside were entertained by a band and a firework display. However, it didn't fully go to plan, according to the Waterford Standard.
"A few roughs made an attack on the band about 8 o'clock while playing before the Great Hotel, but the matter was speedily suppressed, the only injury done being the breaking of the trombone."
Fond of animals, Lord Doneraile later died in 1887 after being bitten by his pet fox. The 4th Viscount is known to be the last person to have died from rabies in Ireland. The Northern Standard newspaper wrote about his death on the 3rd of September 1887.
"Further particulars are to hand respecting the sad death of Lord Doneraile from hydrophobia. On Thursday, his lordship became gradually worse, but was quite conscious up to the time his daughter, Lady Castletown, arrived from Dublin. Chloroform and morphia were administered constantly throughout the night, with the happy result of depriving the disease almost completely of its horror. His lordship was extremely popular with his tenantry, and his loss generally mourned, and he was considered one of the best authorities in the world on foxhounds."
Baroness Castletown took over the running of the estate, but as she was female, the title passed to his nephew. The separation of wealth became evident in these decades. Whilst upper-class society attended races, social gatherings and first-class train journeys, there was a stark contrast to other locals in the area. The Halley family were still living on Main Street in Tramore in 1890. James's youngest son, also named James, was born in the town in 1882, and he carried on the family business of the butchers on the main street.
At that time, the Halley family house was valued at £17.10, which was quite an expensive property.
One family seeming to struggle during these years was the Marr family, one of my own ancestors. Evident by a petty sessions record, James Marr was convicted of stealing food from a shop.
At the petty sessions in Tramore on 12th of May 1884, the prosecution by Barry Sharkey was on behalf of the Queen summons James Marr of Tramore. The cause of the complaint was the larceny of 9 heads of cabbage from the property of William Kelly to the value of 9 shillings at Crowbally in the said county on the 4th of May 1884. Defendant was convicted and sentenced to 14 days of hard labour in the county jail.
In the 1880s, Alfred and James Budd, local landowners, sparked improvements on the racecourse yet again.
The train was built and people were coming out, but they weren't making any money on it, really. People were able to get in free. So in the 1880s, the Budds built deep entrenchments, 18 foot wide, all around the course, and these were flooded during race meetings. So therefore, people couldn't get in, and there was only one entrance into the race course.
Dining rooms with bathrooms were built in to entertain the gentry on race days. 8 turnstiles and a carriageway were also erected. Budd's new and improved course was hailed a gigantic success during the 1881 meeting. and was deemed one of the handsomest racecourses in Ireland. The racing festival that year was so successful, it brought about accommodation issues for tourists in the town. Private homes became lodging houses at busy times, not only to quell the hunger for accommodation, but also to bring in additional income for families. The admiration for Bud's race meetings was short-lived, however, as organisers decided in 1882 to move the racing festival from August back to July. For those few years, the Tramore Festival became a smaller event, outshone by racing meetings taking place in other counties. In 1890 then, a Kilkenny man, Martin J. Murphy, rejuvenated horse racing in Tramore. He leased the race course on the back strand, added a racetrack, two more stands, a cycle track and a golf course, bringing employment to the town as well as attracting more tourists. Mentioned in the Irish Times in 1892, Murphy was also noted as a man who had done wonders for the growing popularity of Tramore.
Tramore underwent a significant change from 1850 to 1911. It was primarily residential with mostly lower class housing in 1850, but evolved by 1911 to become a thriving street with large commercial industry.
Significant investment and attention to Tramore saw the southern coastal town prosper in certain areas.
A new seawall was built, the precursor of the present day promenade was started in 1893, which employed over 100 labourers and tradesmen locally. Also, the town's water scheme started in 1896, which created more employment. So people were coming out to live here. They were either lodgings or there were houses being built.
The amusements initially came to Tramore in 1895, and their success encouraged them to become a permanent annual fixture at the seaside. The number of visitors also rose.
In 1902, it was recorded that over 4,000 people came to Tramore that summer. There were public baths with hot and cold showers for hire, and one was operated on the main street by Mr. Cal, which was actually where the V Bistro is now.
Tramore's main street was now a commercialised centre, as private dwelling decreased from over two-thirds of the properties on Main Street in 1901 to just a third in 1911. Most houses had increased in value, but yet again, the lower classes got the short end of the stick. The small clusters of houses mentioned before stayed the same value.
You can see that the valuation stayed the same in all the small labourers' houses over the 60 years from 1855 to 1911, which showed no improvement in the labouring classes, but yet the houses for the more well-off improved greatly.
Ireland at this time had a tense political landscape. The Great Irish Famine continued to have an impact on the lower classes, with many emigrating or simply struggling on the poverty line across the country. Landlords had continued to profit from their investments on Irish soil, and the fight for freedom from British rule was building up to a crescendo. A number of successive land acts changed the land system in Ireland from landlord estates to owner-occupiers.
In 1902, the Land Purchase Act came in, which made tenants able to purchase their own properties. Landlords were compensated if they sold all their tenanted estates with a 12% bonus from the government.
In Tramore, one of the major landlords started to sell off their property.
In June 1908, Lady Castletown, the daughter of Viscount Doneraill, sold a large portion of the Doneraill estate in Tramore by public auction, including most of the houses on Main Street. What that meant was that people could buy their own houses. Finally, they weren't leased or rented.
The Irish Times on the 2nd of May 1908 read,
James H. North and Co. have received instructions from the Right Honourable Baroness Castletown of Upper Ossory to sell at an early date in June. The fee simple ground rents arising out of the greater part of the town of Tramore, County Waterford, which will be sold in lots to suit all classes of investors. James H. North and Co. direct attention of trustees and other to the valuable securities offered in the sale of these rents. The more particularly as Lady Castletown is building a residence adjoining the town and intends erecting public baths, making roads, building villas and generally developing this well-known and fashionable watering place in accordance with plans which have already been prepared.
Then, the Land Purchase Ireland Act 1909 allowed for compulsory purchase by the Land Commission of tenanted farmland. The breakaway from Britain was starting to show. Over 32,000 people migrated to Britain for harvest work in the 1900s. The population figures didn't change much in Tramore, rising only by 194 people between 1871 and 1911. On the main street, the Fleurys, who owned the business with the most expensive rates in the 1850s, moved away from the centre of the town in the 1900s. Replacing the Fleurys at the building where Welcome Takeaway resides today was the Broaders, a widow and her daughter.
The Fleurys stayed in Tramore until the 1940s, but they moved out of the main street. In 1901, there's a family called the Broaders living where the Fleurys used to live. Mary Ann Broader was the only American immigrant on 1901 census, and she lived there with her mother, Margaret, a returned immigrant.
Ireland was divided over the issue of home rule in the 1900s. The Irish Volunteers were set up to fight for Irish independence from Britain, with the Ulster Volunteers founded to oppose independence. The Home Rule Act was delayed by the outbreak of World War I in 1914. As Ireland was part of the British Empire, many Irish people joined up to serve, one of which was a young man called John Hannigan from Main Street.
John was 12 years old when he was on the 1901 census. At the outbreak of World War I, he enlisted in the Australian Army. He was employed as a stretcher bearer, which is one of the most dangerous jobs, as they had to go out on the battlefield, sometimes under fire, to collect the dead and wounded. He was injured in the chest and later developed TB. He was discharged with a pension. Hannigan's medical records state that a mild injury, together with exposure and infection, caused his disability. And then he died in Fremantle at the age of 27.
At the same time as World War I, Ireland was still fighting to achieve independence from Britain. Many Irish were against Home Rule, which eventually erupted in the 1916 Rising. The Irish War of Independence commenced in January 1921 and Northern Ireland was established. At this time, IRA units were active all over Ireland, including Waterford. In January 1921, an ambush took place at Pickardstown, where two rebels were killed, although initial reports announced the death toll as three. An article in the Belfast Newsletter on the 10th of January 1921 detailed the incident.
Three rebels were killed by a military and police party which was on its way on Friday night to the relief of the police barracks at Tramore, a well-known seaside resort about 8 miles from Waterford. Three barracks, which was defended by 12 police, included some auxiliaries, was attacked about 11 p.m. A fierce fire being maintained for a couple of hours. The police stubbornly replied to the fire. In the meantime, relief parties of military and police set out from Waterford and about 1 mile from Tramore were ambushed. The attackers were routed, three of them being killed. One of the constables defending the barracks was wounded, being shot through the thigh. Reprisals, it stated, followed on Saturday, the Sinn Féin Hall and some public houses being burnt down. The court found the deceased were shot by the military in the exercise of their duty.
Away from politics, Tramore was still continuing to develop and was connected to the national electricity supply in 1929. With regards to the racecourse, in 1911, after a particularly bad storm in December, which broke through over 160 feet of the embankment, swept away the hoardings of the racecourse and flooded the golf course beyond repair, it was decided finally to move the racecourse away from the beach, and a new one opened up in 1912 on Grawn Hill, where it still operates today. While on the 31st of December 1960, the Pride of Tramore left the station for a final time. Following a report from the government examining public transport in Ireland and their profitability, after 107 years, the doors of the Waterford to Tramore railway service closed for good. Back on the main street, and plot number 69 remained Halley's Butchers until the 1940s.
By 1911, Michael Halley's grandson, James, was still a butcher on Main Street. He married in 1917 and had two children.
James Halley moved away with his family to his wife's hometown of Clonmel and opened up another butcher shop, while a relative looked after the one on Main Street. James Halley's direct descendant, Jim Halley, returned to Tramore and now operates a legal practice just three doors up from where his family lived in 1850.
My name is Jim Halley. I'm a solicitor in Main Street in Tramore. My family were originally from Tramore. My grandfather's family were butchers on the corner of Main Street and Market Street, Tramore. They were Halley's Butchers. I suppose really I'm a blowback into Tramore in the sense that my family went out and I'm back again. I started on my own practice in 1984, initially on the terrace opposite AIB Bank. Then I bought a premises on Main Street in Tramore, which was known as Eldon. We've been here ever since, initially as James Halley, we're now Halley Pork Solicitors.
Halley's Butcher Shop was demolished in 1944 and replaced by the Rec Cinema and later Cal's Shop.
I'm Michael Clark, I'm the owner of Cal's on Main Street, Tramore, formerly the Rec Cinema. My parents came down from Dublin in 1967. I would have obviously known the cinema very well, it was the Rec's. And the Rex was there in my time, so yeah, I would have gone to the Rex. I would have known as well, so pretty much in my psyche, all right. When I came here, we for a short while, I remember we just stayed in a flat, which is next door to the Three Swans, which was Murphy's. The two buildings were originally owned by Mrs. Corcoran. We stayed in a flat there for a few weeks, and then we stayed in Whittle's, which is now Meze. But then we moved down to the terrace, so I've always lived in the middle of the town. So if you're talking about the mid-60s or... and 70s, like it was a standalone town because people just didn't go into Waterford. It was quite busy then, so it's great that it has expanded retail wise and commercially, and I say there's a huge amount of extra employment in the last 10 years in particular, but I would still say challenging for an independent business to survive in.
Tramore has seen its fair share of ups and downs over the centuries, from its humble beginnings as a fishing village 8 miles away from a busy port in Waterford, to now being a destination town attracting people from all walks of life to its sand, sea and sometimes sunshine. With everything the town has faced, it's a wonder what Tramore's future is yet to bring.
Main Street, presented and edited by Debbie Ridgard. Researched and produced by Mary Claire Ridgard. This programme was made with funding from the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with the television licence fee.